The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com.
More with Bill Myers.
Good morning. It is Conspiracy Theory Thursday, which means that, you know, as much as I'll talk with anyone normally, I'll talk to even more when it comes to things that are on your mind this morning. 770-563-3770-KMED. Yeah, we'll just give you more of what you always like here on the Bill Myers Show, 770-5633. Now, there is, there is a rule here. Well, maybe a couple of rules here when it comes to being a talk radio host and, of course, you being a talk radio listener and or caller. And that is when you do call, have a point, get to the point as quickly as possible. Pithy is always good. And if I hang up on you, it's not normally something personal. If I hang up on you and go on to the next caller, it's because we're going to the next caller and keeping things moving. It's not being rude. You know, sometimes if I hear you make a point and you've made a great point and I think that we've wrapped this up, I don't always have to say, hey, have a nice day, this, that, the other. Looking forward to you. Call at the bar. No, we just kind of go to the next call. That's the way that works sometimes. Now, other times, maybe we have a little more time to, you know, sit and visit, but just wanted to explain the etiquette of it. And if I end up, you make a point and then I move along and then you try to call back in because I didn't let you, supposedly you had two or three or four or five or six points, that doesn't work. That doesn't work. So your most important, it's kind of like if you were writing for newspapers back in the day or if you're writing for the web right now, you put the most important stuff first. Okay? All right. I don't explain the rules very often, but people will say, well, why did you hang up on this person? I said, well, that person made a point, and then I moved along because there were three or four or five other people waiting to get on. And there we go. They're not like hard rules, but the more intelligent and the more cogent you are about it, a lot of times the more. Now there are times that I will let it go for a while as I'm trying to figure out, all right, where is this person going? Now I'm just trying to help you see it from my point of view sometime because, you know, as the host, my job is to try to keep it going. I'm not always successful, but my job is to try to keep it successful and moving along. All right. And that's all. It's never anything personal. Naturally, if you're going to get and start dropping F-bombs, and there are a few people that have done that, you immediately go away. That's just the way that goes. And it's because it's not about the First Amendment. First Amendment doesn't mean I can let you drop F-bombs on the public airwaves. That's just the way it goes. So now that we've kind of explained things and we understand one another better, then you can go ahead. So don't ever take it personally if I hang up on you. All right. It's just moving along. I thought you made the point. So make your best point first. There we go. To make that point, 770-563-3770-KMED. I read a lot. And some of the most interesting books have been coming out this year. It's just been really, well, there's the fiction books. Like I was talking with the French spy the other day, Paul Beaumont. And the Frenchman and the follow-up to it. Oh, I'm just loving it. I mean, that's my entertainment. That's my porn, so to speak, you know. It's like, oh, my gosh, we got these smart spies and they're doing spy stuff. And people who need to die badly, you know, that kind of thing. And I really enjoy that. And then there are other types of books that are also very important, also very enjoyable reads for different reasons. And I'm going to talk with an author about this here in just a minute. His name is Paul Tice. I'm going to talk with him in about 20 minutes. And he wrote a book. I'm going to hold a copy of it up to the Facebook Live, The Race to Zero, How ESG Investing Will Crater the Global Finance System. Now, given that we live within the finance system and we get our money and our Social Security benefits and pensions and wages and gifts and all the other things, when you hear that kind of talk coming from a 40-year Wall Street veteran that where they're taking this Marxist capitalism, essentially what Paul writes in this book, essentially what we are experiencing right now with this transformation of the financial system, And part of it is from the technocrats like the Klaus Schwabs of the world, the Klaus Schwabs. And you will eat the mealworms and you will own nothing, but you will rent it all from us because we, the elite, we will own everything and rent it to you. That's sort of, these people are serious. These people are quite serious about it. And a lot of this has already infected the system. And many people are still under the impression that when they buy a stock or a bond and they're investing in something, that the people who are running the companies are running the companies to generate the most amount of profit and give you a good return on you. I mean, you giving them a buck and they give you 10 cents a year, let's say, or whatever, you know, it might be, that they actually give you a profit on it. That's not true anymore. It has been happening for about the last 10 to 15 years, and it's really been speeding up recently. And a lot of it because of the climate change fraud that has been perpetrated on it. And we're in the process of building this technocracy. This technocracy, we've talked about technocracy a lot. Technocracy, the scientific dictatorship. One of the ways they're trying to accomplish this is by this ESG investing, in which companies no longer operate for the benefit of you, the shareholder, but for the good of society. You may also hear it termed stakeholder capitalism, which means that everybody who doesn't have skin in your game has control, and you, with actual money and your wealth in the game, are considered, we don't really care much about you. Seriously, this is where it has been going. And Paul not only talks about the sources of it, and it is Marxism. It is Marxism. It is the communist revolution. I remember it was a number of years ago that I would start calling Democrats in Oregon commies, and people would be really upset about it. And it's like, well, no, this is really where they're coming from. The regulatory state, the United States of America, supposedly, you know, you're proud to be an American, or at least you hope you're free, et cetera, et cetera. The United States is now being taken over by this. European Union's already been under attack by it for quite some time, and they being more socialistic have been more open to it. It's been more difficult to get this totally implanted into the American financial DNA. But it is a really interesting topic, and it's something that is important to know, and I think it's important to know how to work around it. We've been talking on not just Conspiracy Theory Thursdays, but on many other Thursdays, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, for that matter, on how to invest or work around these intrusions in the American system into capitalism. Because stakeholder capitalism isn't capitalism. Stakeholder capitalism is Marxism or communism or one of the – it's a collectivism. And we have to stop kidding ourselves. And he does have a part in the book there about the exit. And he calls it the 2030 exit plan. The one thing about communism and the communists and the collectivists, if you just want to put it under the collectivist umbrella, they're very open about setting the goals. And that's what's been happening here in the state of Oregon. A lot of it comes through energy, control of energy, control the energy, control the economy, control the energy, control the food, control the people. Paul will talk about that, you know, here in a little bit. But I'm just kind of giving you a little preview of where this is going. And how many times have we been hearing about this? Goal 2050, pathway to 2030, Vision 2040 in Jacksonville, where we don't have cars in downtown Jacksonville, but we have out-of-work loggers towing tourists around in rickshaws. Those were one of the proposals. I continued to bring that up a number of years ago. Yeah, that's these are the kind of destructionist ideas coming out of these people. And what Paul says in this book, The Race to Zero, is there has been a lot of the investment world, the people that are supposed to be looking out for you, they've been holding back. They've been holding back and thinking, all right, this is just going to be an investment fad. It's kind of like the way Republicans have been, too. to a certain extent, in which, hey, you know, all this this woke communism and getting all of our kids into the public school to question their gender and cut off their genitalia by the time they're eight just because they say so. And this is just going to be a phase, and it's going to be okay, and that's all right. We'll elect another Republican or two in November, and that'll take care of it. No. It goes a lot deeper. It goes a lot deeper than that. And in the investment world, like I mentioned, going back to the investment people that have been saying, okay, I'm just backing off. What Paul's concerned about is that there's going to be very soon a capitulation in which the regulation of the communists within the system right now are so great that you're just going to have to throw in the towel and play the game, or else you don't have access to money. We'll talk about this here in about 10 minutes. I think it's going to be a really interesting talk, and Paul has a great reputation, and the book is a very important book. I mean, it is a really good read, but it's also a very important read to understand the attacks and the intrusions that we've been dealing with here in our state, in our country, and on the world stage, too, for that matter. Same kind of intrusions that we've been dealing with the Democrat pushed charter changes. You know, it's bringing it back to the local view. Everything is about breaking down a system which has worked for more than 100 years here in Southwest Oregon, the way we've been running these counties. The goal from Democrats, also known as communists, the way I look at them, but I just wish they changed their name. Remember, the Communist Party USA no longer runs presidential candidates because they say that the Democratic Party fulfills their dreams, their goals. So why are we still calling Democrats Democrats? But I digress, okay? Back to the three-person boards that we currently have that are elected at large, that the Democrats, mostly Democrats, are attacking with these charter changes, 17-116 in Josephine County, and the three measures in Jackson County, one to go to a five-member board, cut the salary, and make it nonpartisan. Right? That's so you can hide the Democrat from the ballot. That's essentially what it is. Like, hide the salami, I guess. hide the rotten salami in the ballot. As it is right now, we have three strong commissioners in both counties that look out for the entire county. Democrats want to break that down. Now, they're breaking it down faster in Josephine County at this point because they want to go with this measure to districts, in which you slice and dice Josephine County, and then you represent your district, not the whole county. They eventually want to do the same thing to Jackson County. They've openly admitted this, but they're going a little more incremental in Jackson County. One way or the other, we can't be fooled and must vote to defeat these communists and their goals, what they're trying to make happen here, okay? But I wanted to remind you of something that happened yesterday on my show. And if you haven't gone back and listened to the podcast, it would be well worth listening to my interview with Captain Bill Simpson. Captain Bill Simpson talking about the challenges of getting the Board of Supervisors, the county commissioners of Siskiyou County, to declare an emergency and defend their people from the economic and environmental rape going on with the removal of the Klamath Dams, okay? And he was talking about how Ray Haupt was dealing with the problem and sympathetic to the people that were describing their problems and, you know, crying about their life being destroyed, their lives being destroyed, okay? Their lives are being destroyed. And Bill said something really interesting in that interview, and I caught it, and I asked him. I inquired further. And he talked about, there was another commissioner from Shasta, and he didn't seem to be all that concerned about it. And then I asked Bill, do you have districts in Siskiyou County? Because I'd never really investigated the structure of Siskiyou County's government. And Bill said, yeah, we elect districts. We elect our county board of supervisors by districts. I said, isn't that interesting? You had Ray Haupt, who was caring about the destruction of the Klamath Dams and how it's been raping his people economically and environmentally, just destroying their lives. But he's caring about it because they're in his district. And the other board members, or at least one of the two of the board members, are kind of like going, oh, so what? I'm down in Shasta. I'm in the Shasta district. I'm a different one. I don't care. That's what the communists want for all of us. They don't want county commissioners that are all concerned about the entire county. They want us divided and fighting amongst ourselves at the county level. It was, as Barack Obama used to say, a teachable moment. It's worth getting that podcast, by the way, BillMeyerShow.com, or go to KMED.com and listen to that interview with Bill Simpson. It's a classic example of how difficult it is to get a district-wide county commission to move on something. If it's only happening in one district, the other ones are kind of like going, oh, so what? I'm part-time. Let me move along, okay? How's my CalPERS looking this month? You know, I'm being a little cynical about that, but we're talking about human nature. We are much smarter to stick with what we have. Three county commissioners elected at large by the entire one. And if communists can't get elected to the county commissions, it's because people don't like communist ideas. You don't have a majority of people in Jackson and Josephine County yet in favor of full-blown communist ideas being on the county commission. So there we go. It's a 628 at KMED, KCMD. This is the Bill Myers Show.
I'm Bob, and I'm thrilled to share my experience winning the metal roof giveaway from Stephen Westfall Roofing, Inc. Winning was a total shocker. I never win anything. But thanks to the amazing team at Westfall Roofing, Inc., my home now has a stunning new roof. From the brothers to every single employee, their professionalism and efficiency were top-notch. They even went above and beyond by helping with some extra junk removal. Not only does my home look better than ever, but its value has also skyrocketed. Thank you, Stephen Westfall Roofing, Inc.
March is Maintenance Madness Month at Kelly's Automotive Service in Grants Pass in Medford. We want to remind you to check your fluids at least once a month to help avoid costly repairs. When you come in for any service at Kelly's, we do a thorough inspection that includes pictures and videos of the good and not so good of your car that are texted and emailed directly to you. You then decide what to fix and how to plan for the future. Check us out at kellysautomotive.com. Kelly's Automotive Service, where we service your vehicle but take care of you.
2x4, 2x8, who do we appreciate? Hughes Lumber, Hughes Lumber. Tweedledee, Tweedledum, the carpenter just hit his thumb. Twinkle, twinkle, little star, what lumberyard has the best repertoire? Hughes Lumber, Hughes Lumber. Mary had a little lamb, but it needed fencing from the ram. She also needed a brand new barn, but only one company has the charm. So when it comes to lumber, what's your choice? Say Hughes Lumber and rejoice on Crater Lake Highway, Hughes Lumber.
Hi, I'm Mark with Oregon Truck and Auto Authority, and I'm on 106.7 KMED.
Holly Martin, Joe County Republican Party Chair here. Hey, Holly. Had a PCP meeting last night. What happened?
We did. Well, a couple things. One, you know, we're all coming to terms with the fact that Southern Oregon is really in peril. You know, they sent this gal in to run the Democrat Party here in Josephine County, and she's an operative. She knows exactly what she's doing. All of a sudden, they're packing our Republican Party candidates for this election with people that we know are on the left. Mm-hmm. So they're really making an effort to take over the party.
In other words, are we having essentially Democratic operatives running as Republicans in some cases? Is that what we're looking at?
That's what's happening. That's what's happening, and also people that are just really far to the left, you know, who are constantly making deals in Salem. We just can't have that. What I really love about Dwayne Junker, and by the way, he got a unanimous endorsement from the party for his run. What I really like about him is he's just up there saying no to things that we need to say no to. He's not making a bunch of deals. And people that are up there keep trying to convince us that, oh, gosh, you know, we all have to, you know, make deals. We got to work all these things out. We don't have the vote. Yada, yada, yada.
Well, I found it interesting because I was talking to another county, a state rep the other day about this very situation in which I said, okay, if you have a Democrat, if you're a Republican and you have a good idea, it never gets in the bill. It just doesn't. So why did you vote for the bill like the Measure 110? And he said that, well, you know, there were some good things in the bill. I said, but yeah, but there was a lot of bad stuff in the bill. And you give it legitimacy when you cut the deal and give the communist Democrats political cover to do what they do by agreeing with them. You know, they don't need your vote. So why do you help them out? And are there enough Republicans that are thinking that way yet? Dwayne seems to understand that quite clearly.
He understands it clearly. The Robinsons were there last night. They understand it clearly. And oh my gosh, Noah Robinson spoke at our meeting last night, and it's just crystal clear that he gets it. He absolutely gets it.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm going to talk with him at 8:10 this morning. You know, the part that I'm still not understanding is why the Republican Party, Party of Oregon and or, you know, Southwest Oregon here, why are they not questioning Christine Goodwin's, where she lives? She lists a winery. She lists a winery as her place of residence. It makes no sense. And whether the Secretary of State approved it or not is irrelevant to me. It doesn't make sense.
What we decided last night, she did come and speak to us. And although I've heard a lot about that and I've seen some very compelling evidence, and it's very upsetting, we decided not to confront her in a public forum last night, to just go ahead and let her speak. But let me tell you, it's very upsetting. Number one, it appears to be true that she does not live in the district.
And yet she is running in the district to knock out the Robinsons.
She's running in the district. So rather than running against Brock Smith, they got their little group together and decide who is going to do what. She's going to go ahead and run in our district against the Robinson family. The trifecta of the most, probably three of the most informed and intelligent guys in the county. I mean, they're absolutely fantastic, fantastic guys. So I think we will be confronting this issue about her not living in the district. The reason for that is that it isn't even just it's not a political play, and that's what we don't want people to see it as being, some sort of a political play just to, you know, to get one candidate in. But the fact of the matter is, it puts the Republican Party in a horrible position.
Yeah, let's say that if she were to win that Senate seat, and then the Secretary of State, who is a corrupt political operative, in my opinion, right, then decides, oh, you know, that, you know, you really aren't in, you don't really live in that district here. You're disqualified for the election. So there you go. That's what can happen.
Right.
Bottom line.
They could do it at any time. They could do it right after the primary, and then we're in a tough situation, or they could do it after the general election. So it puts the party in a hideous position.
Indeed. Well, thanks for the report. Yeah, thanks for the report and keeping up on that, Holly. I got a roll here in just a minute, but we'll talk a little later, okay?
All right. Bye-bye.
Josephine County Commissioner Herman Bearchigger, yeah, that's commissioner. I'm talking about Josephine County Republican Party Chair, Holly Morton. There we go. I'll get it all straight. Herman, by the way, is not running, from what I understand. Tom's in Talent. Hello, Tom. Go ahead.
A lot of debris hitting the fans.
You got that right. What's up?
You know, your comment about the supervisors of Siskiyou County being elected in districts, and so only the supervisor near the dams was really motivated to look at what was going on. Mm-hmm. And you were lamenting that. Do you realize that the Democrats here that are trying to do what they're doing to Jackson County for all would consider that a success?
I know they would.
And yeah, so it's just like that's what's going on with that. And I also wanted to say about, you know, we're having a tough time describing the kind of so-called government that's descending upon us. It seems to be an amalgamation of technocracy, communism, and fascism.
Yeah, it is a big mess, but it essentially is the collectivist, the total.
Yes.
You know, collectivism in which the individual doesn't count for anything, but only the hive mind. You know, that is it. And we're going to control you. The hive mind will be controlled by the king and queen bees at the very top, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think the Democrat Party will not be satisfied until we have a full-on police state. They, you know, do not like free speech. They don't support real democracy, just their democracy.
Exactly, their democracy, Yeah, not our democracy. When they say our democracy, they really mean their democracy. And on that note, Tom, I would be happy to talk a little bit further about this. I'm just running out of time here, but I think you just made a great point. And I have to get Paul Tice on because Paul Tice is expecting my call. And
take a deep breath, Bill.
Yep, and I will. You know, and we can't allow them. We cannot permit this police state mentality, collectivist intrusion in our system. Appreciate your call. It is 6:37.
When the IRS comes knocking, the news can be shocking. Tell them you've hired a CPA tax expert at First Response Resolution, located in Eagle Point. Leave speaking with the IRS to Zach. He'll defend your rights as a taxpayer. Visit FirstResponseIRS.com today for a free consultation.
Two Dogs Fabricating knows trailers. They sell trailers and repair trailers. So if you'd like your trailer inspected, bring it to the dogs and they'll sniff it out. Two Dogs will check the axles, hitch, tongue, lights, bed, brakes, and more to make sure your trailer's roadworthy. Most trailers on the road are fine, but it's good to have it checked out once a year. They'll scrutinize crucial welds for corrosion and cracks, too. And if you need any repairs, you'll get a quick, reasonable estimate. Two Dogs Fabricating on Bryan Way, off Sage in Medford.
News sponsored by Caveman Heating and Air. It's the climate and we control it. Call Caveman Heating and Air at 541-476-0009 or cavemanheating.com.
Good morning. I'm Natalie Cerna with your NBC5 Morning News Update. Oregon's Prescription Drug Affordability Board is hosting a series of community forums across the state to hear how prescription drug costs affect Oregonians. There will be 5 in-person forums across the state. The Medford one is on April 25th. It'll start at 6 and go until 8 p.m. at Rowe Community College's Higher Education Center in Medford. There will also be 2 online-only forums. For more information, you can email pdab@dcbs.oregon.gov. And the South Medford High School girls basketball team is celebrating their state title win with local elementary school kids. Wednesday morning, the gymnasium at Kids Unlimited Academy was packed with cheering kids, showing their support for the Panthers' historic 3rd state title. Saturday, the team beat Benson High 48-38, earning the 6A title. At the assembly, kids presented the team with flowers and hand-drawn posters. The team's coach, Tom Cole, who's also the founder of Kids Unlimited, says this win is a result of countless hours of hard work and dedication. When they're not winning state titles, the team coaches the Kids Unlimited kindergarten through second grade basketball program. For local news anytime, you can head to our website, KOBI5.com, or our Facebook, KOBI/TVNBC5. That's a look at your morning headlines. For NBC5 News, I'm Natalie Cerna.
Hi, it's Jason at Phoenix Auto Center Tire Pros. Through April, purchase a set of 4 Cooper tires for practically whatever you drive, and you'll get a Visa reward card in the mail. Get $100 on top of the line Cooper Discover STT Pro Mud Terrains or Cobra Instincts for your sports car. Get $75 on 5 styles of all-terrain truck tires, including the popular AT3 XLT, and get $50 on 3 styles of all-season passenger tires, including Endeavor. Save on Cooper tires at Phoenix Auto Center Tire Pros.
Oregon E-Deals has saved the Rogue Valley boatloads of cash over the years on things you buy and use daily. Get a $100 Cartwright's Market gift card for only $85. Artisan Bakery certificates, normally $25, only $15. American Rancher Garage, $75 certificates, good for any service, only $30. Wayback Burgers, $25 certificate, only $14. This and much more available exclusively at OregonEDeals.com.
The Bill Myers Show is on 106.3 KMED and 99.3 KCMD.
20 before 7, one of the most important books that I've been reading as of late is from Paul Tice. And let me tell you about Paul Tice here. Interesting man, kind of an underachiever, and I'm teasing Paul, but spent 40 years working on Wall Street, some of the industry's most recognizable firms, the big names, J.P. Morgan Chase, Lehman Brothers, Deutsche Bank, Bankers Trust, BlackRock, too. Wow. And most of the time you specialized in energy. Isn't that the case? So you've been one of those carbon guys. Fair enough, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Bill. Good to be with you. I've kind of specialized in energy for the last 30 years, both as a sell-side analyst and then as an investor.
And you're also a teacher, an adjunct professor of finance at New York University's Stern School of Business. And your opinion pieces appear everywhere. So you're everywhere. And you've really written an important book here. I'm going to hold it up to the Facebook Live once again. The Race to Zero, How ESG Investing Will Crater the Global Financial System. Now, Paul, when I see a book that says will crater, not might, or hey, if we keep going, it's going to, I tend to pay attention to this because I think that what we think of as woke capitalism or stakeholder capitalism, you've been hearing all these kind of buzzwords out there for quite some time. Quite seriously, is it designed to take us down in the first place? Why don't you start there? Is it actually designed to take the system down, as we know?
Yeah, I think there's been some, there's obviously been pushback the last couple of years in terms of the anti-ESG movement. But one of the reasons why I wrote the book is because I think the focus has been somewhat misplaced. Rather than some of these woke issues, which might fall under the category of cultural wars, not to diminish them, but I think those are secondary. It's all about climate change when you're talking about ESG, and the goal is to defund oil and gas. And if that succeeds, going through the back door of the financial markets, it's going to impact every American in terms of the cost of everything, not just energy, but also food. It'll make the inflation of the last 2 years look like child's play, and it'll restrict everyone's economic freedom. So we really need to keep the focus on climate when we're talking about ESG. And the other side is fairly open about what the agenda is, talking about net zero at every turn. But I thought it was important to write the book because no one's really articulated that, and certainly no one from within Wall Street has ever offered a critical view of ESG, because basically no one who works in the industry is allowed to do that. And I experienced that firsthand over the back end of my career.
You're not allowed to bring up the fact that what they're doing will actually, in fact, you even have a chapter in there destroying the fiduciary rule, right? And maybe you could explain how that would be done through ESG. Maybe we need to start back at the beginning. First off, if people who don't know what ESG is, define that first, and then we'll go through how they attack everything with this.
Sure. So ESG stands for environmental, social, governance, and it's based on the theory that these non-financial factors, all of which are morally subjective, should be driving your company policy as well as your investment decision making, as opposed to objective financial metrics that we've been using for decades. And it's all predicated on the theory of stakeholder capitalism, as you mentioned, which again is the novel concept that a company needs to be run not for the benefit of its owners or its capital providers or its employees, but for the benefit of society. People and planet, is the language of the left when they talk about that. And obviously that's not capitalism. It may be the end stage of capitalism if we don't turn this thing around, but it's basically the government working through third-party activists, including the United Nations, to direct the private sector and the financial markets, and that clearly falls under the category of fascism. And it's a pressurized system. No one can really speak out when the CEO of every firm is telling everyone, this is what we're going to do. And so, obviously, if you work on Wall Street, you're not going to get paid, and you may lose your job, ultimately, if you are critical of this. So everyone is under pressure to comply, because anyone who speaks out becomes the next target.
Did you speak out, and were you pressured to leave at any point? I know this is kind of a personal question. I don't know if you've addressed that in the book. I haven't completely finished it yet.
Well, over the second half of my career, I worked on the buy side. And the buy side, asset management firms, asset owners, they're really the driving force on Wall Street around ESG. And so I worked at a number of different places through the 2010s when ESG was really picking up. And, I've always, had a public voice around energy, which, was my expertise. At different firms, you would start feeling the heat and not being able to issue op-ed pieces that talked about climate or ESG or sustainability. I wrote a piece, I guess it's 6 years ago now, just talking about sustainability and divesting from fossil fuels. The United Nations has a investor group, which is really driving this, the Principles for Responsible Investment. And after I wrote that piece, the CEO of the PRI sent a nasty email to the dean at NYU Stern, where I teach, basically telling him that I should not be allowed to have a public view. So it just confirms that no one is allowed to disagree with this, and they're trying to shut down dissent, just like they've been doing with climate change for the last 40 years, saying the consensus is there, and there's no room for disagreement now.
Because, well, this is too serious of a situation, right? To disagree with this, you're going to destroy the planet. I can't help but think that ultimately, when you have woke capitalism, stakeholder capitalism, fascism, corporatism, this sort of situation, when you hear the Klaus Schwabs, and a lot of this is also coming from the World Economic Forum, like you said, and a lot of people are just saying, he's just a Bond villain, a bad Bond villain, and people are paying too much attention to that. But when they talk about changing people's diets and you will own nothing and be happy, well, someone will own it, and I can't help but think it will be the winners of ESG. Is that a fair assessment of
I think it is. I mean, as I mentioned, I think the United Nations has taken the lead on the intertwined agenda of climate, sustainability, and now ESG investing. So they're all three legs of the same stool that's been constructed by the UN. But the World Economic Forum has been the fellow traveler of the UN around stakeholder capitalism and climate, for really the last 40 years. And we need to remember that the other side has a 40-year head start on us in terms of pushing this agenda. But I would view the World Economic Forum as kind of, throwing up trial balloons around a lot of these concepts to see what flies. But we're taking a risk if we laugh it off or discard it at this late date in the game, because a lot of what the World Economic Forum is proposing, as ludicrous as it sounds, is already being implemented over in Europe. I mean, we have 15-minute cities in a number of places across the UK. We're shutting down farms, or trying to, in the Netherlands. And we're talking about tracking everyone's carbon emissions. And again, that just confirms the point that defunding oil and gas, going after fossil fuels, is a way to restrict everyone's economic freedoms. And if you give everyone a carbon counter going forward, it's only the rich who will be able to pay for those carbon credits every year. So clearly this is kind of an elite agenda that's being pushed through politicians and NGOs and third parties. But it's going to be very regressive in terms of the penalty on the lower income stratas of society.
But you scare the kids. You scare the kids to go along with this, too, that if you don't, that all of a sudden somehow you're going to destroy their life, right? The Greta Thunberg kind of way of looking at the world.
That clearly is, there's a whole chapter on that, too, in the book, because clearly that they're making this generational argument, and they're using young people and children as basically human shields in here, because you can't really debate with any of them, obviously. And if they can indoctrinate, one, two generations, then once those children become adults, they'll be in positions of power. And we're already seeing this in business and Wall Street. They already have that mindset going into it. So that's why, you lose it after two to three generations, if that's the goal. And that just shows the long game the other side is playing. But again, it just shows you they don't have an argument, right?
Children are crying, so you must destroy your economy, right? That's kind of what's happening right now.
Right. Yeah, children are going to set your energy policy because that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Race to Zero, one of the most important books I've read lately, and I'm about halfway through it. You need to get it. The Race to Zero, How ESG Investing Will Crater the Global Financial System, by Paul H. Tice. Paul, this has been going on a long time, and how do you think it got such a toehold in what is ostensibly a free market capitalism system? How did it infect it? What started this? Do you know? Were you able to go to the beginning of this? Was it the technocracy movement of the 1930s where it got started, or maybe some other time?
Well, I mean, you can trace the threads of ESG back, 100 to 200 years. I mean, if you start, it's just the latest attack on capitalism. It's the latest attack on fossil fuels. And there have been, different arguments made against fossil fuels. But the climate argument against fossil fuels is one that's very tough blow off if you buy into the theory, which again, it's a flawed theory. So, but it's part of a 200-year assault on capitalism. And it's interesting, the initial assault was through Marxism, which focused on taking control of the means of production through the labor function. Now we're doing that through ESG, taking control of capital, right, which I think is obviously the more effective way to get control of the private sector. So, but you can trace it back to the 30s. You know, you mentioned corporatism. That was the dominant economic approach or business approach coming out of the war over in Europe. And, you know, it's not surprising that European firms and asset management firms are pushing ESG primarily. You know, the force is strong with them in terms of a lot of the regulations, you know, the climate change goals that they set for the European continent. So, yeah, they're you know, this is a long game, and you can trace it all the way back. But I think it's one of the more effective ones right now, again, because if you can control capital, you can starve industries and companies that you think are out of favor and then steer capital towards, you know, the ones that you want to finance.
So this goes way beyond a one bank or another bank that will not process credit cards for, let's say, a gun manufacturer, right? That kind of thing. It's way beyond that.
I think that I would view those as symptoms, right? And you've got a lot of CEOs that believe in this, right? I mean, obviously, you know, Larry Fink would be a clear example of an outspoken person who supports sustainability.
I think that his last name is a perfect he has the perfect name, in my view, okay?
So, I mean, and then also you have examples with Disney and some of these other firms, right? But for every true believer running a company, there are, I think, many more that are just afraid to speak up, right? So fear factor is something we need to acknowledge in terms of coming up a way to relieve the pressure on everybody. But over the last 10 years that this ESG has seemingly come out of nowhere, I think what's allowed the movement to gain inroads is the financial crisis in 2008, you know, gave Wall Street obviously a really bad image, right? Wall Street wrecked Main Street back in 2008. So they needed to work on their ethical image, and ESG allows them to signal their virtue. And what that's done is suckered in basically everyone on the street, and now they can't find the exit door. And what's changed over the last several years is that now ESG means you have to align with the Paris Agreement, you have to get to net zero around your portfolios, you have to align with all the sustainable development goals. So the ESG program has become more mandatory and prescriptive, and now we have regulations coming in Europe and the U.S. that are going to make this whole system mandatory, and that needs to be the focus in terms of the pushback.
And anyone who understands energy, as you do, as many people do these days, if you understand real energy, like even then, I still have people that don't believe me, Paul, when I say, hey, listen, for every windmill Pacific Power puts up out here in southern Oregon or out in the eastern Oregon, wherever it is, there has to be 100% backup by some real power form, power source that can be spun up at a moment, right? But what they're trying to do right now is just make us live on the sustainable or the renewable energy, as it were, and nothing else. And that doesn't work, does it? There's just no way to make something like that work in any kind of industrial society, unless you don't want an industrial society or a lot of people. Am I wrong about that assumption?
No. And I think we need to speak obvious truths about what's going on here. If you were rational and the other side, you know, is, you know, inconsistent logically at every turn. But if you want to electrify the entire economy, which is what they want to do, you wouldn't at the same time be changing your generation mix to intermittent wind and solar and pushing out coal and not allowing natural gas to come in and not figuring out how we can build nuclear in this country again on an economic basis. So you're making the grids more unstable, and calling it demand management when you have power outages is just a nice way of saying, you know, if that occurs during the winter, people are going to die, as we saw in Texas. So it's not rational, but the regulators at the state level for the last 20 years have been pushing intermittent wind and solar into the generation mix, and it requires backup, and the backup is only a few hours. So, yeah, by definition, we're going to have, you know, unstable electricity, a problem we haven't dealt with in over 100 years, and that's going to lead to less economic growth.
And you know, I think. Yeah, and we're going to shut down farms, and we're going to slaughter cattle and not allow them to live anymore because of methane emissions. I mean, all this kind of stuff. And people are just thinking, well, it's just a policy choice, and then we'll. It's almost like there's an assumption that there'll be some miracle that will save us from really evil choices being done right now. Would you agree with that? That's part of this. That that there's so little rationality in these policy decisions?
Yeah, again, I a few points to make. I think we need to take the other side at their word that they're committed to this.
Yeah.
They do want to shut down fossil fuels. And what's being done now in terms of agriculture shows you how extreme the other side is in its rhetoric. But obviously, if you control food, that's another way to control the overall population. So I think they clearly are bent on shutting down specific industries. And, you know, we need to acknowledge that. But, you know, this regulatory complex that we're dealing with and all of these rules, you know, they were put in behind the scenes, you know, through the executive agencies and through the judicial system. No one ever voted on this in this country. In order to reverse it, we're going to have to use the same tactics as the left. But I think we need to take them at their word that it's going to get more aggressive between now and 2030, which is a magic date for climate as well as ESG in terms of what they want to accomplish.
Don't you find it interesting how the collectivists, the communists, whatever you want to call them, they always have those interesting dates, 2030, pathway to 2040, vision 2050. Isn't that interesting? And they right out there in the open.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing about ESG. You know, it is a fraud in terms of the argument that's being made about leading to better performance for your portfolio. But all of this is playing out in the open, right?
Yeah.
It may be less than transparent in the financial markets, but, you know, it's an outright fraud taking place in the public eye. And I think the public needs to focus more on it because we can't dismiss this as another culture war skirmish. This time it's real, I think. And we're talking about a lot of money that flows in the market every day. And if the left can control that, you know, through the prism of ESG, then they can control the entire capitalist system.
Paul, you wrap the book up, and I haven't gotten to it yet. Maybe you can give us just a little taste of it. A 2030 exit plan, because you're saying one of the challenges is that I think a lot of people in the financial world are thinking, this is going to be a fad. People will move along. It'll collapse because nobody can make any money. But you're saying that there's just so much pressure to get in line with this. How do you think we even begin this issue to get off the 2030 path to destruction, really, ultimately?
Yeah, and I think that's another way that the movement has made inroads on Wall Street is because everyone on Wall Street is told, keep your head down, just focus on making money, right? So no one is really looking at the big picture. And frankly, back in 2008, nobody was looking at the big picture. And the people running all the firms on Wall Street obviously took their eye off the ball in terms of what was happening in the subprime market and how that infected the rest of the markets, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think people, the first thing and the reason why I wrote the book is so we can acknowledge the scope of the problem and then figure out the right way to push back. The title of the book, particularly the subtitle, is meant to be blunt so that I think we can acknowledge, you know, the risk that we have now to the economy and to our financial markets. But I would view it as kind of like Dickens' A Christmas Carol. This is the ghost of Christmas yet to come unless we change our ways, mm-hmm. right?
Right?
And there is still time to do that. But we need to be thoughtful around it. So, you know, it's going to take government resources. Frankly, ESG is progressive politics that's masquerading as finance. So we need to acknowledge that and not let the other side try and shut us down by telling us that we're just being political.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone needs to pick a side. So we need to go with the Republican side, even though, you know, there's been less than a strong commitment across the board there. Certainly nothing like the Democratic side. And I think the red states are going to need to continue to take the lead on this and sue around all of these regulations that are now coming out of the SEC and the FDIC and the Department of Labor to push them back and then keep going. We need to attack all of the climate regulations that have sprung up in this country, even though the Paris Agreement was never submitted to the Senate. It's a treaty, should have been. And I think the first time we get a Republican back in the White House, hopefully at the end of this year, that should be the first order of business. Because if you take out the legs of climate change and all these regulations, then ESG will just blow away in the wind.
What about us in our own investment choices? Now, we're not giving investment advice because, you know, I'm not a broker or anything like that or a financial advisor. But personally, I've been looking at, in my little baby investment things, I've been kind of going counterintuitive to where the blob wants to take us. Is that going to be a smart thing, or will people that invest in oil and gas still probably get crushed in the near? What do you think?
Well, I mean, if again, not investment advice, no longer a practicing investment advisor.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the energy sector right now and the regulations that are constricting it, and the fact that the industry has gotten much more disciplined in terms of their capital spending to make them less dependent on the financial markets and exposed to ESG defunding risk, prices directionally should move up between now and 2030 just because of all these climate policies that are being implemented. So, you know, I think that's a good backdrop for the industry in terms of investment performance. There's also scarcity value, and you also see all of the energy companies combining now as the industry consolidates, and you're going to get larger players that have, you know, stronger balance sheets. So I think there's a strong investment case to be made for owning oil and gas. You know, we have to worry about what's going on right now in the economy and the potential risk for a recession. I don't think things are as good as people are saying, but I think over a multi-year period now, the industry has protected itself enough where, you know, they should come out of this fairly well insulated. They're not going to survive ultimately, and that's the other thing. You know, that's kind of a between now and several years. But the industry needs to be speaking out more about what's going on around this rather than cynically hoping that this all goes away and it's a fad, because it's not.
Yeah, I think they've been looking at that way rather for quite some time. You know, I couldn't help but think that everybody that's talking a bit about this, a little bit off the beaten path there, Paul, as we wrap, but, you know, Bitcoin at $60,000, $70,000, people go, ooh, ooh, ooh. And do the people that are pushing Bitcoin ever come to the realization that you need lots and lots of electricity to even run that? Do they even grasp that? Do people even, you know, connect the dots in a system like that to trust your store of value to electrons? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I honestly think most of the people who are buying Bitcoin at the individual investor level don't really understand what exactly it is, right? So it's been described, it's not a coin, it's not a mode of currency, it's not an inflation hedge. You know, it's not a hedge against the market because its beta is significantly above one. You know, so I don't think they understand, and just the whole description of it as validating blockchain transactions, I don't know what that means. And I've tried multiple times. So I don't think people really know what they're buying there. And that's a problem because, you know, you really need to know the risk that you're taking on. So I think that's just another example of how the market over the last 10 years, in the absence of volatility and very low interest rates, has kind of grasped at every, you know, latest fad. And, you know, we'll see where Bitcoin goes over the long term. But I don't think a lot of people understand exactly what they're buying there. And the people selling it, I think, have a responsibility, certainly through some of these ETFs, to know that their investors are sophisticated enough to know what they're buying into.
The part that concerns me most about that is that a lot of people are thinking, oh, this will keep me out of the reach of government. Oh, no. What are they thinking that government can't crack these codes if they really want to at some point? That's another aspect of it, and that we'll just start taxing you for it. Ultimately, they're going to go there. You know that, I would imagine, right?
Yeah, I mean, the whole argument that this, you know, is a safer way to protect your wealth, I think, has been somewhat specious and countered by the fact that so many criminals actually use cryptocurrency for illegal transactions. So there's a disconnect there. Again, you know, if your investor's not sophisticated to know all the risk, or you can't articulate all the risks, which a lot of the proponents for Bitcoin, I think, fail at, then we shouldn't be pushing this onto the general public. So, but again, it's the latest irrational exuberance to point to. And right now, obviously, you've got a tailwind behind you, and we'll see exactly when that next peaks.
Yeah, the hunt for yield, right? That's the search right now. The hunt for yield's a tough one. But anyway, this is a fabulous book, The Race to Zero, How ESG Investing Will Crater the Global Financial System. And as Paul Tice said, it's sort of like this is the ghost of Christmas future if we don't get our butts in gear right away. Paul, great job. I'll get all your information up, and thank you for sharing a few minutes with us this morning about this important topic. You take care.
Thanks, Bill.